This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Literary Disco. Is this how it goes, Julia?
So far, so good.
Okay, welcome to Literary Disco, everybody. I'm Todd.
I'm Julia.
And she's Julia. And normally, we are joined by actor, writer, camper, which we'll get to in a moment, writer strong, as part of the show Literary Disco, which by this point, usually an episode has already been formally introduced, but we don't really remember what writer says at the beginning of an episode.
He's not here, so...
He's not here. So I do know this is episode 196.
Okay, good.
And she's essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel.
And you're novelist and critic Todd Goldberg.
And writer strong, actor, director, camper, writer strong is also usually on the show. And we are three old friends who love to read, write, talk about it, and sometimes... I think we
agree.
We agree or we disagree. Huh. And then when do Joey and the girl who sings Smelly Cat, when are they on the show?
They're not on it. It's just you and me.
That's just friends. Well, anyway.
Yeah. As Todd is alluding to in the most awkward way possible, it's just us.
It's just us. But this is a thing that has happened, Julia. Like, almost every summer, is you and I are forced to do, like, a summer reading episode because Ryder has fucked off into the woods.
Yeah. I mean, this is a good opportunity to talk about what I assume is both of our favorite memory of Ryder when we were first friends, and Ryder just got it into his mind that he was going to build the biggest beach bonfire known to man. Staggered around finding trees from God knows where, creating a giant bonfire. And I think that's when we really knew what we were getting into friendship-wise.
Well, that's true. But Julia, have you not been looking at Ryder's Instagram while he's been gone?
I have been, actually.
So you saw
the bear?
So, listeners, here's the weird thing. So Ryder has an Instagram that he ignored for, I'd say, a decade. And then all of a sudden, like in the last 2 months, he's begun posting things. And right now he is documenting in detail this nationwide camping trip he's on. So if you and your family are in the highways and byways of America and you're stopping someplace and pitching a tent, you might run into TV's Ryder Strong with his wife and child, Alex and Indy. And so, you know, the pictures are great and they're beautiful and they're hiking and they're doing stuff that Jews don't do, like, you know, shitting in the woods and stuff. And then, like, there's a legit, like, bear, an ursine, that is attacking their campsite. It was horrifying.
Yeah. I mean, this is why you don't go to the woods, Todd. So
right.
If any of our listeners happen to be new, which, welcome to podcast.
Welcome to episode 196.
Ryder's definitely on the mountain man end of the spectrum, and let's just say Todd had a refillable Starbucks card before anyone else knew that was a thing. Those are the two ends.
Yeah, that's correct.
And I'm in the middle, but I'm going camping next week too. So, I mean, I've never encountered a bear on the trail though. That would be a lot.
Yeah, so listeners, if you go and you look on Instagram, just look up Ryder's name, and he's got a verified account, so you'll know it's him. But there's an actual movie, and when Ryder's back, we will for sure talk about this. There's an actual movie of like a big ass legit bear eating their stuff. And then there's some photos afterwards of like, you know, books that the bear had ripped up and things like that. So here's the other legitimate difference between Ryder and me. Like, if that had happened to me, Julia, like, that's it. We're done camping. Like, I'm in a car. I'm coming home. We're staying in a Radisson somewhere. I'm not like, oh, yeah, a bear showed up. Like, no, that's it. I'm fucking done.
Well.
So, we're not big campers.
But anymore. I do, not too early pivot to us actually talking about something relevant. But I think I am excited because when Ryder goes away, it is our chance to talk about the absolute trash that you and I willingly read that Ryder right. would not read.
Or That's correct.
Would at least tell us what's wrong with America for it being published.
He does have some opinions on what's wrong with America by virtue of things that were written 50 to 60 years ago.
So we have... We have an angle for today.
Yeah.
And we also have, you've contributed something else strange for us to discuss. So,
yeah, so
how should we get into it?
Well, the first thing is we're going to talk about some stuff for the anti-camping, which is the sitting by the pool. We've got some books for you to read while you are sitting by the pool. Some classics, some new stuff. So we'll get to that in just a sec. But today was a weird day because all of a sudden on Twitter, a thing blew up that we had talked about a couple years ago, which was that short story Cat Person. Do you remember that, Julia?
Of course I do.
It was like this viral sensation. It was a short story that was in The New Yorker, and it was right at the beginning of the explosion of Me Too. And we actually did an episode 123, about some short stories that clearly had influenced Cat Person. And we talked about a short story called Stitches by Antonia Nelson and A Real Doll by A.M. Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
And this episode, if you go and look in the archives on Spotify or iTunes or whatever, is still right there. But so this short story, it was this big viral event, and then it sort of disappeared. And then the author's book came out a year or so ago. It was not a huge seller. But Cat Person was again back in the news because a movie was greenlit based on it, starring one of the actors in Succession, which is a show that I've seen two episodes of. So it's been floating around again in the zeitgeist. But today it blew up again because there was an essay in Slate, and we'll put a link up to this on the Facebook and Twitter, by a woman who said, the person in Cat Person is me. I'd always suspected that this story was based on me. I reached out to the writer and I found out that it was true. And it is a bananas essay. But so here's the thing. Like, if you know writers, invariably you are going to end up in their work, whether you like it or not. Like, you just show up. And sometimes it's in a simple way, like, you know, someone will say something to me and I'll be like, hey, just so you know, I'm taking that line, like that belongs to me now. Or I'll say, hey, you've got 2 weeks to use that if it's another writer. And if you don't use it in 2 weeks, it belongs to me. And these are conversations that happen all the time. But, you know, I have seen myself in other people's fiction, and I have for sure seen myself in nonfiction. I mean, there are two memoirs out this year that I read where I show up in them, and both times not as tall as I think I am, frankly. But you know, that's what happens when your friends are writers, you know, and you play an active role in their lives. You show up sometimes, and of course, all of us have based characters and situations on people that we know. I mean, you do that for sure, Julia, in your nonfiction. You're writing about your own life.
Yeah. I mean, you fictionalize yourself. You interpret yourself as a character.
Right.
And you interpret, I mean, I think with nonfiction in particular, it's super interesting because when you're really in it as a nonfiction writer, you're just seeing the world through that essayistic lens and you're making meaning that is creative, you know, at all times, even while you're like experiencing real life. So yeah, everybody can get sucked into the cyclone of that process.
Right. And, you know, in my own fiction, you know, I'm not a gangster, you know, I've never killed anybody, but, and we've talked about this before, periodically there will be someone who walks into a story of mine and astute readers will be like, oh, it's so lovely to see your wife. You know, like there's a character in The Low Desert, a wife character, who is so very obviously my wife, Wendy, that anyone who's ever met her before, it's like, oh, I didn't get a chance to see her. That was so nice to encounter Wendy for, you know, four pages or whatever. And I, you know, I've fictionalized my mom in my fiction before, but always in stories that are not really about my real life. They just, you know, they're in a way the people that are in my life become archetypes in my fiction. So in this case, though, it was a little weird. So the thing that hinges Cat Person as a short story, the thing that made it so salacious, was this violent, awful sex that these two characters have. And then this texting relationship that is horrible. Mm-hmm. And then this conclusion that ends with this man walking up to this woman in a bar and calling her a whore for essentially ghosting him. Like, that was the stuff that really, you know, churned the internet up, was all this salacious stuff. But the woman who wrote the essay in Slate, and we should pull up her name instead of just calling her the woman, as though
very
she
good,
is
very good.
In a 12th century novel. The author, who
Kristen
is,
Rupinian.
That's the author of Cat yep. Person, Kristen Rupinian. And then the author of the piece in Slate is Alexis Nowicki. Essentially, Alexis Nowicki and Kristen Rupinian had a shared boyfriend slash friend at different points in their lives. And this person subsequently died. And Alexis Nowicki recognized this man from the details of their relationship, which was that he was older. He was 33 and she was a sophomore in college. And in the short story Cat Person, Kristen Rupinian gives this woman, Margot, the same job and characteristics as the real woman. So all this stuff ends up being true. But it's like the mundane stuff that's true, not the salacious stuff. But the essay, you know, she confronts the author. It's really kind of troubling and strange. What'd you make of it, Julia?
I think this is just so bizarre because, I mean, I understand why she wrote it and why Slate published it. You know, like, I see why this piece exists, because it's fascinating that she could recognize herself in a viral New Yorker story.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, that alone is amazing.
It's
that
weird.
It was
yeah.
that mainstream. But I feel like this is a style of essay that is almost outdated at this point, of like, it happened to me. I was in a viral New Yorker story. When really what's very jarring about that is this guy died, and the essay
right.
is about like her personal, like the title, which I'm sure she did not write, is
right.
Cat Person and Me. But there's a right. dead guy. Like, it's
right.
about a dead guy. Both the original short story and like we're talking about a man's life here.
Right.
So that I found very jarring. This like super long meditation on her relationship with him and, you know, the fact that it was written into a short story. I just don't feel like that's front page news. But I do think for a lot of people, it is interesting to see how a life can become fictionalized almost by accident. You know, she never met this writer. She just
right.
knew a guy who knew a writer.
And he didn't tell her that he knew the author.
Yeah, right.
So that's the important thing. So Nowicki reached out to this man that they had in common, and he didn't tell her that he knew her. It wasn't until years later, until after this man's death, that she found out that they knew one another. which is strange. But there's this part at the end of the essay that I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
She says, what's difficult about having your relationship rewritten and memorialized in the most viral short story of all time, and we can get to that, is the sensation that millions of people now know that relationship as described by a stranger. Meanwhile, I'm alone with my memories of what really happened. Just like any death leaves you burdened with the responsibility of holding on to the parts of a person that only you knew. Mm. Okay.
It's true.
It's true, but she's also Streisand affecting her own issue that she's having. She's like, this thing happened where I've lost a piece of myself. Oh, you should, here's an essay in Slate all about it.
Yeah.
It's like she's both horrified by having this part of her life end up fictionalized, and she wants you to know that it was her.
Yes, exactly.
It's a strange sort of turn, because we don't need, like, you could hold that memory of this man and who he was without ever telling us that any part of it is true. This is the thing, though. This is the strange compulsion we have as a society, right? Like, we want to both shock you and tell you that, oh my God, this part of the story is true. We want you to empathize that something was taken from us, and we want to be a part of the story.
Yes, exactly. Like, if I were her, would I tell this at every party I'd ever go to for the rest of my life? 100%.
100%.
Would it be part of my two truths and a lie at any icebreaker? Yes.
Yes.
But I think it is, I think there's a question here that she doesn't really answer or acknowledge, which is, can this fiction writer get at something true? By borrowing the extremely bare bones details, you know, that she borrowed, you know, like, is this short story unworthy of being published, or was it wrong to do this? Because it was based on these real people. And I think no, like, it was still a great story.
Yeah. It's still, well,
it was still
a story. Yeah. Still a story. But the things that happened to her and what made it into the story are so mundane as to be normalized anyway. Older man dates a younger woman, they have a fucked up relationship. Like, that's why when we did the episode 2 years ago, or however long ago it was, we said, hey, look, this story that has taken the world by storm, this is not the first time the story has been written.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the story Stitches by Antonia Nelson that we talked about, or essentially any short story that Elizabeth Crane wrote in her book When the Messenger is Hot, is the same short story. Or any Mary Gateskill story that has ever existed. It's the salacious parts of all those writers that changes that narrative. It's the turning of the normal into the abnormal that makes them interesting stories. That's what made Cat Person interesting. Mm-hmm. That's what made it so much of its time. It's just such a strange thing. And I was talking about it on my Facebook page where, you know, the majority of the people on my Facebook page are authors. And, you know, half of them were like, oh, she's trying to cash in. You know, she wants a piece of that movie deal. She's going to sue for life rights or, you know, whatever it might be. Which I don't think that seems to be what she wants.
Yeah,
but maybe
so
she wants,
either.
You know, some secondary fame from it. But also it's like, the solicitation of the author and getting the author to apologize for it when all fiction is taken from people, like from yourself or from those around you or from living. That's what we do, is we make fiction that hopefully has some sort of empathetic appeal because it feels like it's about real people, because we're inspired by real people. Like that's what literature is. That's what art is.
Yeah.
But by the same token, like when I hear someone say, like, oh, you know that Dan Fogelberg song, Auld Lang Syne, where he meets the woman in the grocery store on Christmas Eve? That's true. And that I was the girl. I eat that shit up. I'm all about it.
Like, yeah, because we want to know that it's really true. We want to know that our sense of this story or song piece of art, like, that it feeling authentic is right. You know, it validates the authenticity in a way. But it's funny. I don't know. It's... All right. So is Cat Person a story about a 33-year-old who dates a young woman who works in a movie theater? No, that's the you know, situation. But it's not what it's about. It's about sexual assault and the creepy ways that men trap and put down women verbally. And so even though it's so strange, the same things happened, huge air quotes happening, listeners. Right. You know, these stories aren't the same. They're not about the same thing. They're not really in the same realm of reality. Even though the fictionalized version feels very authentic.
Yeah. And, you know, anytime I go anywhere, anytime I'm interviewed, someone will say, well, like, what part of this is true? Well, no part of it is true. Because I'm not a fake hitman rabbi, or I didn't just, you know, cut up a body in the trunk of my car and now I'm driving away with a clown. Like, none of that happened. But there is a clown who walks around Palm Springs and I see him in bars. So, you know, I'm imagining his life. And maybe in Rupinian's case, I think I just mispronounced your name. In any case, the author of Cat Person... you know, she took these people who she knew, this one person she knew, and she imagined him as a worse version of himself.
Yeah.
That's what art does, you know? It creates worst case scenarios and then tries to untangle them for you. The whole thing gives me heebie-jeebies.
Do you think if when, to play for the other team for a second, if when he read this piece... You know, and if he recognized himself, which is part of this essay, you know, he asked her, like, am I a bad person? You know, he's not present anymore to give his side of the coin. So I think it would feel less strange for him to write. In fact, that would be fascinating, is for someone
that
to say,
like to read.
I was villainized or I was made to represent all men. When really I'm just one guy, you know, that is very interesting.
But we've read those, you know, like we've read those pieces where someone says, I was the unnamed person in this essay where I was a horrible rapist fucking asshole and that woman's a liar. And that doesn't go well.
You're right.
You know, that does not go well at all. But, you know, in the essay itself, it says that he had kept this old iPhone so that he could go back and look at old text messages between himself and the author to make sure, like, he had never done anything gross like that, and he never had. But, you know, then it begins to put fear in your mind, like, did I do that? And I don't remember. You know, am I Tyler Durden? Do I have an asshole twin who calls women whores? I feel like of course she has the right to tell her story. You know, she wants to tell the story that's her right, as it is for all of us. But I think it's the essay itself, it seems to be aiming at saying, like, it's not your right to make up stuff based on other people's lives.
Yeah.
You know? But only in a really broad way.
Yeah, I mean, could this author have changed two or three details that would have made sure they never recognized themselves? She could have.
Yeah.
You know, she could have done that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it reminds me sort of why we now in nonfiction do that thing, right? At the beginning of a book or an essay where we say people and names have been changed or folks have been combined or whatever. Or they're based on a character. Because no one who's been portrayed as an asshole comes out and says, yeah, that was me.
Yeah.
I was the asshole. That's a true story. I think you're willing to come forward if you appear as the good guy. And then there's always those stories of, you know, like the ex-boyfriend of Elizabeth Gilbert or whatever, suing her or, you know, all this sort of crazy shit that happens and never ends up looking good for anybody involved.
No.
But that's more often in nonfiction than in fiction. Because fiction's fiction.
fiction does give you that umbrella, you know, that defense. It is, it's that, then there's a lot to be said for saying, like, this is clearly fiction. And even if it is about you, you can protect yourself and your emotions by saying that.
Right.
But this debate is as old as literature itself.
People in the Bible were like, let me tell you something. Jesus wasn't that great.
Yeah. And before we stop talking about this, I do have to say, I think Shirley Jackson would have to have something to say about the most viral short story of all time.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of hyperbole in calling that the most viral short story of all time.
What do you think is the most viral short story of all time?
Well, I think virility has changed.
Yeah.
Because while this was an extraordinarily popular short story that existed on Twitter and people were reading it, I don't know how many people actually read it as much as they talked about the thing that was inside of it. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to say, like, it's not like Cat Person is more important in terms of being widely read than The Cask of Amontillado. You know what I mean? It's not more viral than The Raven. It's not more viral than The Lottery. You know, or even The Things They Carried.
The you know, Dead the, by James Joyce. I'm Googling.
The Dead.
Yeah.
You know, it may have been a touchstone for conversation, but it hasn't changed literature. Not by a long shot. But, you know, there are these things that become important for a day or two on the internet, and then we forget about them, but they're still part of the larger cultural conversation. And, I was thinking about this woman who admitted that she'd fallen in love with that tech bro guy or the farmer bro guy. And
I don't know what you're talking about. Oh, yes! Martin Shkreli or whatever his name is.
Yeah, the journalist who had fallen in love with him.
That story was so weird.
It was so weird, and it was so important to me for about 16 hours, and then I don't even remember her name.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone gets their chance in the crosshairs on the internet for a day, you know? And this was a short story that it was emblematic of a larger issue of that time. But I don't know in terms of the quality of the story. I don't think it stands the test of time. I just reread it. It's a good short story. But you know, like we said at the time, it's not better than everything Mary Gaitskill has ever written.
It's just right. It was just right on the money time wise. And there's a lot to be said for that. Like, good for her. Good for her.
Yeah. I mean, and she got the conversation going, and she also suffered from it, you know. She was getting bashed all over the internet. She had, you know, asshole men and, you know, incels and shit coming after her. I mean, no one wants that from a little short story that you write. I mean, that's crazy. We don't write short stories in hopes that we change a cultural conversation. We write short stories in hopes that the New Yorker publishes it.
Yeah, exactly.
and then it does. And then all of a sudden, for her at least, it became a cultural touchstone. The majority of short stories published in the New Yorker, all they do is get you a really nice book deal with Knopf afterwards. They don't get every 19-year-old on Twitter talking shit or praising you. But, you know, I still look at it as a piece of literature. Other people look at it as a piece of the zeitgeist. And I don't know if I don't know if in 10 years people will remember what this thing was.
Yeah, and I think what's really fascinating to me is that her apology email, the author's apology email to this essayist, is in the essay.
Yeah.
And she had to know that this email would become public, that there would be another piece. So it's all sort of this tie. Like, now if you get embroiled in one of these public events, you know that everything you say is going to be part of the backlash to the backlash to the backlash. So I just can't even imagine what work of emotion and care writing that apology must have been. And it's solid. She did a great job.
Yeah, I mean, and both people clearly also are hurting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing, you know, maybe this is it. Maybe that's the thing that makes it feel skeevy to me, is that both people are hurting. Both people clearly cared about this man who is now dead. And neither of them knew he was dead, you know, until long after it had happened. And so by the time they're having this conversation, they're both also mourning this person that was at some point important to them in their lives. And it feels a little invasive to be reading about two people who are mourning the death of a person that is also the centerpiece of a piece of fiction that is now the centerpiece of a piece of nonfiction that we are now discussing on our podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think, I know we got to transition away from this, but there is this one piece in the middle of the essay, and I'm like, this is where this woman's lack of skill actually becomes really, really interesting. Like, she hits on something that I think the essay should really be about, which is, we are all unreliable narrators, okay? Cliche, whatever. Mm-hmm. But then, sometimes, to my own disappointment, I find myself inclined to trust Rouparian over myself. Had Charles actually been pathetic and exploitative, and I simply hadn't understood it because I, like Margot, was young and naive? The answer could be yes. You know, like, we're seeing her work out her own, like, she's learning from the story, possibly, or at least the story is making her question right. Something that is really interesting and important. So,
except that it's a piece of fiction.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, like, Rouparian could have made up everything. and then you try to ascribe the reality of your life based on someone's fictional interpretation of a secondhand story. Yeah, it's a lot. Well, it's a lot to work out. I don't know if I'm going to have to think some more about this. I might have to host a panel discussion about this in my next MFA residency. My students are talking about it, too. I saw that they were talking about it on their Slack page today. Because, you know, they're all writing about each other. But, I mean, so here's the last thing. Like, this is the other thing. It's like, when you're in a creative writing program, you see people working out their shit between each other a lot of times in the short stories.
Oh, that's
like,
funny.
Like, you see that shit. I mean, that's what all of those workshop novels are about. It's like half of them are about, like, this is the shitty person that I took a fiction workshop with. Or those essays that end up in Salon or Slate, for instance, where they're like, oh, I was in a class with Josh Ferris and he was a fucking dick to me. You're like, oh, he was in college. You know, like... People are dicks. There is some desire, though, to see into that reality of how fiction writers get to their stuff, right? It's all about where the magic come from. Like,
yeah.
And here we actually see, like, oh, she cooked this recipe from some shit she found.
Mm-hmm.
so there is, you know, from a process side of things, there is some interesting stuff in there. But it's not the first piece that will question these things. As you said, it'll probably not be the last time we talk about it.
Well, this has been a very intellectual discussion, and so I think we need a hard pivot.
Yes, pivot! Pivot!
I don't want to do Friends references. This is...
Pivot! Did you watch the Friends reunion, though, Julia?
I did watch it. Of course I did.
We watched it like 10 times.
Are you serious?
I cried. Oh, yeah. I loved it.
Oh, wow. I mean, I like... So... Quick Friends history on me. I had seen Friends, who hadn't, but I moved to China when I was 22, and you could get illegal DVDs for $1 a DVD, and my friends and I would just buy like hundreds of these DVDs, which I probably shouldn't admit, but
I don't think Warner Brothers is gonna come after you.
So I bought all 10 seasons of Friends for like $6, and I watched it all.
It makes good sense.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, I know it. I know Friends, and I love some of the characters, but I recognize the problems it's had with aging. So I enjoyed the reunion, but it wasn't like a deep connection. It was like, what am I going to put on in the background while I work out?
Oh, no. Like, it was on... And Wendy and I got up at like 8 o'clock in the morning and watched it.
Wow.
Okay. Like it was on first thing in the morning we watched it.
These are the things we can never talk about when Ryder's around.
Yeah, because Ryder would mock me for my love of Friends. I love Friends.
Okay.
Like that was my era. Look, also my hair looks like fucking Ross's. Let's just be clear about this.
So Lisa Kudrow is the best person on Friends, and I will have no other discussion.
Oh, she's great.
Who's your
and
favorite?
Her mom or her dad is my sister's gynecologist.
Okay.
I know that's weird.
All right. Anyway, we gotta. I don't know how to get out of that one. Looking for a transition. So, Todd, tell the fine people what we're talking about next.
Well, okay. So here's the deal. Typically, we would now be talking with Ryder, and he'd be like, okay, this is a book I read in 1979. I was in Columbia, and this great professor who's been dead for 75 years. And
1979? Wasn't he like 1 or 2 years old?
Just go with it, Julie. Just go with it. And, you know, he taught us that in the summertime, like, that's the time to really improve yourself. And so every summer I read, and then he'd say some name, like in French, and you and I would just be like, yeah, yeah, that sounds right.
Heard of that.
Yeah, I love Gizba. But in fact, the truth is, Julie and I have very basic taste.
Yeah.
And
we like to lounge.
We like to lounge. And that means, like, when I'm by the pool or at the beach, I don't read high art. Like, there are videos and photos right now of Ryder on his vacation camping, where he is literally reading the book that Julie and I have not yet started to read for the show.
Which I was going to say, speak for yourself, but that's a cold, hard fact.
Yeah, we're going to read East of Eden at some point, and it's a very long book, and Ryder is already, like, you can see him flipping pages on his camping trip. Yeah, I'll start reading it very, very soon. So when I would go on vacation, like when I was a kid, I would always bring just absolute total trash with me to read by the pool. And there's a picture of me hanging just down the hall from where I am right now, where I'm sitting at this fishing camp where we used to go every year, Loon Lake, Washington. I look like I'm the fucking keyboard player in The Cure. I got crazy hair. I'm wearing a Bauhaus t-shirt. And I'm literally reading a 70s pulp novel while doing all that. So I'm a big believer that when you're sitting out by the pool or sitting out by the beach or wherever you go to burn your flesh during the summertime, that you read absolute shit. Like, it's not, you know, it's not going to be great, but it moves fast and there's some violence or there's some sex, you know, something good. So I'm a big believer that when you are by the pool or sunbathing or whatever, or drunk, that you read a book that's got, like, super sex and violence. It's mm-hmm. got a super dumb plot. Like, that there's nothing of value to it at all. Mm-hmm. That's what it should be, valueless.
Okay, this is great. I was going to kick this off by asking, what is your philosophy? Because we specifically said pool reads, which to me...
Right.
Now, I'm more of a beach goer. I love the pool. I joined the pool this summer with my daughter, and I'm, like, going back to my Jersey roots. I would, like, spend all summer at the pool when I was a teenager. But I think the pool is, like, that's the absolute lowest level.
The lowest.
Lower than
And you're gonna destroy the book, too, because it's going to get pool water on it.
Yeah, and it's like, what's going on with you at the pool? Okay, you're too hot. You are constantly distracting yourself by jumping in the water or getting snacks. You know, there's gossiping going on at the pool. Like, it's much less of a serene, deep intellectual environment than the beach to me.
Right.
This is really
right.
splitting it. But to me, like, I'm sure I've said this before, I read Anna Karenina on the beach when I was 17. And that
while
was
you were
like,
17.
Yeah. But yeah. Still, that's passable, but I'm totally with you. The pool has to be, the book is the equivalent of the Airheads or the chips that you're consuming
right.
while you're reading it.
It is the Fritos of literature.
Yeah.
A Fritos and like a slushy. Like, you're only consuming things that later will give you a headache.
Yeah, and you're going to feel kind of bad about it, but
yeah.
you're also going to love it the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you lose a page, like if a page gets ripped out or you spill slushy on it.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Yeah, if the cover comes off, if the binding
right.
like melts off of your airport
right.
paperback, you're like, oh, whatever.
Yeah. And it's even better if you didn't actually buy the book, but like wherever you're staying, you go downstairs and it's just sitting there.
Yes.
That's perfect.
Yes. Now, I was thinking about this too, and I think there's, for me, there's kind of a, there's even more reasoning here, because it is, a pool read is about fun, you know?
Yes.
And I think part of the fun for me is reading something either so violent or so sexual that there's this weird tension between you and this suburban pool environment, right? Like, you're reading something that if people knew what exactly the words you were reading, it would be horrifying.
Like some Petals in the Wind type shit, you mean?
Well, I'm going to add, because I was thinking about what I really do read on vacation, beach, pool, camping, and airplanes and stuff. And I need to add a category that we have never talked about on the show, because it would be too shameful to talk about this with Ryder here. But you're my safe space, Todd. And self-help.
Oh, my God.
And I'm not talking like men are from Mars, women are from Venus, but in my family, we all get into these, this is a family habit, books about like productivity and habits and like making your life better.
Are you fucking kidding
and
me?
And it is hilarious. Okay. Like, yeah. But that is a good pool read too, because you're just like, oh yeah, let me pick up this book about habits, and I'm totally...
7 Habits of Successful People and that sort of thing.
Yeah, but there's better ones now. There's better ones
I
now.
I hope,
because they're wrapped in a nice little hot dog bun of like actually being about like science.
Oh, I like that.
So I mean, this is a whole category, and I bet a lot of listeners have read them. The Power of Habit, Atomic Habits, Getting Things Done. I mean, there's tons of them. And
see, when I had a real job,
great to read.
Before I was a professional writer, or before I was a professor, when I had real jobs, I always had a manager who would be like, Todd, I know you're a big reader. I want you to read this. And it would be like, you know, 36 Successful Habits of Marketing Geniuses in America. And he'd be like,
sure.
Let's go to lunch on Tuesday and talk about this. And I'd be like, oh, for fuck's sake. Or, like, there'd be the holiday party, and the manager would get everyone the same thing and be like, this book is very important to me, and open it up and be, like, some sort of management strategy book that he got everybody. It's like, signed. I met the guy. I met him at a retreat. Like, fuck.
Yeah. This is... Okay, so I love that you're more upset and scandalized by the fact that I've read these books than, like, pornography, basically.
Pornography, at least, is something relatable.
But I think, yeah, they're a lot of fun because they add to this illusion that like your life can be under control and you're just one chapter away from having your act together,
having it all figured out.
Yeah.
But so
that doesn't
actually,
appeal
though,
to you at all?
Well, I used to read like sort of that strange sort of crossover realm of self-help and teaching you how to write books.
Oh, yes. Okay.
You know, like Bird by Bird or Writing Down the Bones or even On Writing, the Stephen King book. Or, you know, Lawrence Block's book on novel writing. But, you know, really, like the George Saunders book we read is kind of, it's how
it's
to write. But it's also, it's a self-help book.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, hey, you got picked last in kickball and you read a lot and you write stuff. You're not alone.
So it's
sort of a self-help.
Yeah, and that is an interesting category. So I just started reading Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic, and I read like 2 chapters, and I agree with some, like the core of her idea, which is like all people should enjoy creativity. After like 2 chapters, I literally Googled, is Elizabeth Gilbert crazy? Because it's just so absurd. But these books, like, they are so appealing. I don't know what it is. It's the Fritos thing.
Right.
You know, you just, they're telling you will be a better person for reading this. And I'm like, yeah,
but
let me give it a try.
But see, this is the thing. It's like, and we will get to the books that we're about to tell you about in just a sec here, listeners,
yeah.
I promise. So I just read, for instance, my friend and your friend Gina Frangello's book, Blow Your House Down. And that is sort of a book about self-help feminism, but it's also a book about adultery and agency and all this other stuff. And it didn't help me reading the book. It didn't fix me in any way, but it helped me understand things that Gina had done and things that other people I know have done. So in a way, it was self-help not in the way that it's intended, I think, for the people who buy it for a specific reason, but it was self-help for me, like, to understand the population at large, you know? Mm-hmm. Does that count?
No, it doesn't count. No, because we all have women who run with the
wolves, right?
Yeah, we all have things to learn from each other. I think these are things that, you know, they're factoids. Like, again, going back to the party, like, I don't think something that's as complex as what Gina writes, that's not something you're going to, like, drop as a fun fact. But if you can be like, hey, you know, when this company, The Power of Habit is all about, by Charles Duhigg, which is extremely popular, and he has a podcast, and he's around. You know, he'll talk about, like, okay, this company implemented this habit. Okay, this is from that book. See, I'm going to do it right now. Febreze couldn't sell, like, people were not buying Febreze. And then the marketing company, instead of trying to, like, convince people of its powers of making things cleaner or whatever, they worked into the advertising the habit that when you leave a room or, like, after you make a bed, you, like, squirt Febreze, and that's right. That's the habit that is now locked into your life. So when you have these funny little anecdotes or statistics or tips for true self-help, you know, that's what's appealing about it, is you get these little potato chips of, like, oh yeah, I'm gonna link my habits together, I'm gonna do this. So no, Gina's work is too complex for what I'm suggesting.
Okay, but those people who, like, want to link their habits together, they also want to tell you about it all the time. Like, hey, here's this thing that I do that I learned from a book that you should read. I got it for you. I wrapped it. I got it signed for you. He was at a seminar I did.
Okay, well, I'm sorry.
There is a cult-like thing about it, though. That's the thing.
True.
There's a strong cult undercurrent to a lot of these self-help guru people.
Well, that's why you have to have a major sense of shame about it. And leave it behind at the pool when you're done.
All right, so that's your first pick, is self-help books at the pool?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I mean, I have other pool reads. Right.
Well, that's your first one. We'll start with
that. Okay, how about you?
So, I'd like to read something that is so fucking absurd and so illogical.
Okay.
And that has absolutely no bearing on the reality of my life at all, that I can read it and I don't have any anxiety. So I think we've talked about this before, like how Wendy and I were watching that movie Gravity, and all the space junk was flying into the spaceships, and Sandra Bullock's character was, like, running out of oxygen and she was going to plummet to the earth. And I was feeling very anxious. And Wendy was super placid. And I was like, why aren't you freaking out right now? And Wendy was like, well, I'm never going into space. This has absolutely no bearing on my life at all. And I was like, okay. Like, she was so definitive. She knew so well, like, well, I'm never going to be on the space station, so I don't have to worry about this. This is not applicable to me. So the other day, I reviewed a book in USA Today that I quite liked. And it was this book called Falling by T.J. Newman. And the book's getting a ton of press all over the place because it's written by a woman. So T.J. Newman was a flight attendant. And she wrote this book. And this is the horrifying part. She wrote, like, a lot of the book while people were asleep on the plane flying across country, and she didn't have anything to do, so she was writing her book, which to me is like, no, don't be fucking writing your ass book while we're flying across the country. Be on the fucking lookout for fucking terrorists or flocks of geese, or, like, I need you 100% focused and not fucking scribbling shit about your book when we're on a bomb flying across the country.
Weren't you just saying that writers take their inspiration from real life in real time?
So, recognizing this in myself, when I started to read the book, I was like, oh, wow, so she is playing into this very fear that I have, and which is helping to sell the book. And it's the perfect beach book, because the plot itself is just like, it's like elevator pitch gold, which is an airline pilot gets a message while he's already in the air that his family has been abducted. And if he doesn't crash the plane, his wife and children will be murdered.
Oh my God.
Dun, 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 dun. So it's 150% absurd, right?
Yep.
But it's just plausible enough that if you turn off everything else in your head and you're just focused on that thing, it's like, oh my God, like this shit could happen. And it's the perfect beach book or perfect pool book, because like if shit's going on around you and you're a little drunk, like I mentioned this in the review, like the dialogue's not great, but it's like the dialogue you expect in a book like this. But like the action that's happening is intense from page 1 to page 300. It takes exactly the amount of time that you would spend by the pool. It's like a 4.5 hour read, and it's done. And I was like, I told you actually, oh, I already reviewed the book. I don't think I'll talk about it again. But I was thinking about it. I was like, man, like that is the book to go take with you to any public pool or community pool or hotel pool, because it is just absurd enough and just well done enough. And it really is well done. She's masterful with her pacing to get you through the entire thing. And then when you're done, the person sitting next to you is like, what was the book about? And you'd be like, it's fucking nuts. This pilot.
Yeah.
He's got he either crashes the plane or they kill his fucking family. And then the person next to you is like, how's he get out of it? Like, well, you just got to fucking read it. Yeah. I can't explain it. Because you also can't explain it because you've forgotten the plot points already.
Yes. I'm glad you say this, because I have my list of books that I've read just in the last like 2 years. And the ones that I'm like, ooh, I should talk about this for this topic, I have had to look them up and reread what they are about. Because usually you remember the scenario, you know, the little setup that you're describing, and that's it.
Yeah, and that's enough. Like, that's what it should be. Should just be like, that scenario got this person who wrote the book while I was asleep on her plane $1 million for the book, and then she sold the film rights also. Like, if you have that one great idea, like, You're a pilot. You need to crash this plane or we'll kill your family. Oh, shit.
Yeah, and one thing that's
gold.
I think about a lot is it must be so interesting, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, to write a book to spend years working on a book that you know people are going to read in 3 hours.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, your experience of time and the story and everything is, you have to be so aware that what you want is for them to just chew through this thing in one experience.
Yeah.
You know?
It's really weird. Like, when I wrote the book with Brad Meltzer, The House of Secrets, he's really big on really fast pace. So, in his books, which are made for what we're talking about, like, he writes those big, bulky action thrillers, and that's what we wrote together. But they're big and bulky because the chapters are 3 pages long.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 450 pages, but there's only 65,000 words. And so you have the impression that you have digested a huge thing, but it's a function of how they're written with really short chapters.
I will never forget when I was 17 or 18 and the Da Vinci Code came out, that epiphany. I was like, what the fuck? Like, this is a 400-page book and every chapter's 2 to 3 pages and somehow they all end on a cliffhanger.
Right.
But you know what? It's a vibe.
It's a total vibe. It's meant for this sort of thing. Like, to be absorbed in, like, so that you always feel satisfied. Like, oh, if I just have to finish this chapter and then I can go get my kid out of the deep end. It's only like 20 more seconds. Yeah. It's always just like 20 more seconds of reading, but then I'll get the kid out of the deep end. And he taught me that, and it was like, it was life changing. Like, I always sort of knew it, right? But to write like that is a completely different animal. And I'm not, I don't think I'm great at doing that. And so I don't think I've applied that as much to my own work. I think I apply it more to my screenwriting. But yeah, like that sort of, like that book took us, you know, a year and something to write, but it wasn't very long. And people would read it in 3.5 hours. And I was like, for the fucking stress and pain of writing that book, people are like, you buy it and you call me 4 hours later and say you're done?
Yeah, that's what I'm curious about. Does it feel challenging in that way?
A little bit. But, you know, by the time a book comes out, you're also so far away from it in time that you're just happy for it. Like, you know, you can read my new book pretty quickly, and some of those stories are, you know, years and years old. But also, I think, you know, with a short story collection, it lends itself to rereading versus a novel. Mm-hmm. You don't reread a book like Falling. Like, you don't read that, get to the end, and be like, oh, I'm going to read that again. It's like, no, you like, just like you don't reread Jaws. It's like, oh, yeah, it's a giant fuck-off shark, and then they kill it.
And yet I've watched Jaws 25 times.
We've just watched it, but you don't reread it. Like, you can watch it because it's fun to experience it with someone else. But when you're the main character, because you're absorbing the literature itself, you're not going to slog through. Like, and Jaws is, you know, another perfect example of a book like this. But Jaws aspired to be something more. There was this huge undercurrent in Jaws about the social classes at the beach. There's an organized crime element. There's an affair.
Blah, blah, blah. Give me that bite. All this other crap.
It's like, go get that fucking fish. Get that fucking fish. And that's what they do in the movie. It's like, oh, there's a fish and it's eating everybody. We're going to get it.
Great.
And then
one of my favorite movies.
Yeah. An hour and 42 minutes later, it's over.
Okay. I'm going to submit another pool read. I have two I'm deciding between. You just have one more. I'm the one who said, let's not talk about too many. How many do you have?
I've got one more.
Okay. All right. I will submit.
But it's really a genre I'm going to discuss. But go ahead.
Oh, very good. This is a book I read on the plane. So this is cheating. But it is called The Perfect Nanny. I bought it in the airport. It's French. And it's a French translation of this creepy book of a nanny who kills the two kids she's watching. Perfect.
Fuck. It's like one of those books where the title is like some familiar saying, like do-si-do.
Yeah, yeah. And the cover, I'm looking at it right now on Goodreads, is just a close-up on like a Peter Pan collar. Just an ominous fashion choice. And again, like Falling, like this book is actually really good for what it is, but it was so, I think I read it in like 2 hours because there's no extra to the story. It's just this inside this nanny's mind and how lonely and messed up she is. And like she kills the kids on page 2 and the whole thing's a flashback, that kind of thing. Like, you know? Oh, man, just other countries' idea of horror. That's a good pool read, too, you know?
Yeah, and it's a good pool or good, like, airplane, because when I'm on an airplane, I'm going through, like, that full checklist of terror management. And so, like, okay, let's try not to die, you know? Also, don't have a heart attack, and also don't feel like you need to shit real bad. Like those are like
you got a lot going on up there.
Yeah, those are the three things I'm checking constantly. Like, are we gonna die? No. Okay. Am I gonna have a heart attack? No. Okay. Do I have to go to the bathroom? No. Okay. Continue. But on a plane, I can devour a book because I am just so focused on not experiencing anything else around me as part of my terror management that I could just woo, 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 woo. And but I also absorb it really well, which is strange.
Well, I feel like I get a lot more intense about choosing a book for a plane because I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but if you just don't have a book that you're locked into when you're on a flight, that's disaster level for me.
Yeah.
That's like I picked the wrong thing, I messed this whole thing up. now what am I going to do?
That's why I always have on my phone downloaded like 3 surefire 185-page classic noir novels.
That's good.
We're like, no matter what, like, oh, I can read this Donald Westlake book. It's about a hitman who has to go get some jewels. Done.
I am certain I've said this before on the podcast, but my plan strategy, you're going to hate this, is just the biggest disasters I can find. So I read The Hot Zone on a plane. Read The Stand on a plane. I read books about real plane crashes on planes. Yeah,
that's
sinking.
Disconcerting. That's disconcerting.
That's my strategy.
So my second favorite thing by the pool, and when we were on our honeymoon, this was a long, long time ago, I read like 30 of these, is the legal thriller.
Okay.
A genre I actually dislike. Fucking love For the Pool. So like The Firm is the legal thriller, like the point of most excellence. Or any Scott Turow book. I did an event with Scott Turow a couple weeks ago. And I'd met him before years and years ago. We were both up for an award that we lost. And I don't think he remembered me, but I was like, hey Scott! And he's like, hello.
Yeah, no.
I told him again, like, hey man, I just love your books. I've always loved your books. I'm just a big fan of your books. And he was like, thanks. Just smiling and looking like a fucking idiot. And then we're on live and I'm just trying not to be like, oh my God, I'm on this with Scott Turow. But anyway, the John Grisham legal thriller, like The Firm, where it's a guy and he gets his dream job and he's got his brothers in prison. And then he finds out that the law firm he's working for is owned and operated by the mob. Mm-hmm. And they got to get the money and get to Grand Cayman. Oh,
love it.
I love that legal thriller. I don't want a legal thriller that has some large sort of civil rights component to it. I don't want like, oh, we're going to save the wrongly accused murderers. I want like the lawyers to be bad and the one lawyer we're following to be less bad. And I want them like, maybe there's some sort of government conspiracy,
okay,
but usually it's like tobacco or something like that, or like oil, something like that, where the law firm is bad.
You want all bad guys.
I want all bad guys, but I want there to be that smart lawyer, because in my mind, I'm like, I could have been a lawyer. I like to argue. I feel like I'm smart. People tell me I'm smart. I could have totally been a lawyer. And I like the dialogue when they're in court and people are trying to outmaneuver the other person. I love that shit when I'm sitting by a pool. And then I'm like, oh my God, I totally could have been like one of those people that helps select the jury. Like, I would have been that guy, too.
Sure.
And I'm also kind of the judge.
Wow. Okay, so you feel a real personal connection.
Yes. And at no time when I'm sitting at home have I ever, like, I have 4,000 books in my bookcases. At no time when I'm reading for pleasure at home am I like, you know what, I'm going to find me a John Grisham novel. Never. I have to not be wearing underpants, be by a pool, and have flip-flops somewhere near me, and then it is on.
Wow. Okay. I mean, it's true. Almost nothing beats a good courtroom scene. I think that's the American in us. We like seeing our government at work.
Or we like seeing how we can defraud our government.
Sure. Yeah, because it's all about, it's not really about ethics. It's about outsmarting people, no matter the ethics.
Right. It's the getting away with it.
Oh,
we like
exactly.
The getting away with it. Love that.
Yeah. I'm sure most of our listeners have read this. Did you read Where the Crawdads Sing?
No, I didn't.
That was a very zeitgeisty book.
Yeah, it's still like the number 2 bestseller in the world.
Yeah.
But isn't there some dark story about her and her husband like murdering South Africans or something crazy like that?
The author?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll go look that up after this.
Yeah, there's something dark about her and her husband. Like in the 80s. And then maybe her husband got murdered. I might be fucking this all up. There's something dark.
Something not.
And then I wrote an essay about it in Slate where it's like, I was the crawdad. You might remember that essay I wrote.
Yeah, it was weird. I didn't know you had that. frustration thing going on.
Is this the point at which Ryder would just say, okay, we're going to stop talking now because they landed on something funny?
A literary disco. We're not
going
to do that.
Hey, folks. So those are some beach reads. If you're listening and you feel inclined to let us know what you like to read when you're sitting by the pool, put it up on Twitter. We'll retweet it. We'll treat you like a nice person. We'll make you famous. We'll answer your questions. We'll do whatever you
and
want. Because Ryder's not around.
We're not going to judge you. We're not going to judge you.
Well, I'll judge you.
If you read Atomic Habits.
I'll judge you. Literary Disco is brought to you in coordination with LitHub, right? We are produced by Justin Alvarez. You can follow us on Twitter at Literary Disco. You can follow us on Facebook at Literary Disco. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. And we're going to read something else soon when Ryder gets back from his vacation. Maybe he's going to be there. We'll check you next time.